Bit shy there. Imagine how I feel. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This little ritual comes from the Buddhist tradition that the Sangha we're not supposed to talk about the teaching unless we're invited. So this is a formal way of making the invitation. We have a whole ritual here that we live by that kind of orders our life and puts a certain kind of rhythm and etiquette into our lives. And one of the things we do before we give a talk is to express homage to the Buddha and then the refuges, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And this kind of language and ritual I find very beautiful because it does create a sense of dignity and a sense of composure around the various things that we do in our life. But if you're not familiar with those things, then they might seem rather strange. It's the things that are developed in a kind of in a Buddhist atmosphere. Today's talk is titled Surviving Selflessly, and I try to find who invented that talk. Because I wasn't supposed to give this particular talk. Ajahn Sumedho was scheduled to give it, but he had to go to Italy for a function at our monastery in Italy, so he asked me to do it. And then I asked him, well, who thought this title up anyway? And he said he didn't know either. So then I traced the person this morning. Venerable Kusla was the culprit. And he said his idea in naming this title was because he thought the talk is to lay folk and what he perceives in lay life, where people say, that to live in lay life, one has to be selfish to survive. So that's where he was coming from. So, and then his take on it was surviving selflessly. When I first saw the title, my thought, well, why not thriving? Because it seems to me where I thrive is in the act of surrender. Different minds operating in different ways. What I thought maybe I just would mention is just to begin with the theory of work in Buddhism, how in a Buddhist culture we would look at work. And work is usually defined in a threefold way, just briefly here. Buddhists hold work has three functions. To help a human being develop the faculties, to overcome self-centeredness by making them join with others in a common task, to bring forth the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. The last one, to bring forth the goods and services needed for a becoming existence, getting a wage and so on, I think that's how many people see work. It's you do it to get something so you can live your life. But to overcome self-centeredness and to help a human being develop the faculties. By faculties, I should think we mean learning to be a decent human being, developing emotionally, intellectually, physically in a way where one can live in the family, in society, and within oneself in a decent and happy way. So when I think about, say, survival, then it's more than just normal work. Survival always implies, for me at least, life in the extreme, somehow. Extreme emotions, tragedies, Princess Diana, these kinds of things. You think about the royal family, When I think about surviving, it's like something they don't really have any control over. This, the situation is this way. And so the situations where we survive are quite often the situations where we don't have control, where social events or physical events or whatever are bigger than our own ability to manipulate them or control them. I was recently in Eastern Europe and visiting the country of my parents, Latvia, and I was also in Poland and the Baltics and Russia, and there's a lot of poverty there, a lot of confusion, a lot of doubt and kind of almost anarchy with what to do now with their lives, because their old society was ripped out from the roots, and now the collective Soviet society that's collapsed, and so many people are really just trying to survive. As opposed, and so when I came back to Canada and here, I could see that middle class existence is just a bit better than survival. So we do say in this society, no matter how difficult we might think it is, we do have incredible opportunities. We have, like the NHS is wonderful, no matter what we might think about it. When you go to Eastern Europe, people said, bring your own needles, or you get AIDS, or hepatitis or something. So that was an interesting contrast. Yeah. And I could see there, say, I stayed on some old collective farms where the economy has gone to sort of subsistence agriculture. Many people who didn't really know how to do agriculture, and they really are just barely trying to survive. And I could see the kind of massive depression that existed with many people and the anxiety. Interestingly enough, the women were better at surviving than the men. The men tended to go into alcohol because they had no purpose anymore. No sense of pride in what they did. It was mere survival. Whereas the women, their sense of who they were was very much related to the family, of getting the bread on the table and making sure the kids are fed and just keeping going. And so the quality of their minds was much healthier than many of the men. And I was in Riga, and people in cities are like pensioners, people like that, have a very, very difficult time. The way the families work now, many of the families have someone working some bit of land in the country, and the whole family might go out there on the weekend to get enough food to survive in the city. But city rents are high and food is expensive. It's all available. It's there if you've got the money. And so I was walking through in the old part of Riga, and there's quite a few beggars in Riga now. Now, it's not like India. It's not this abject poverty. But the level of existence that they had has fallen, and their cultural roots have been ripped out. And there, you know, so there's this kind of no kind of cultural foundations with which to enliven the mind or to give hope or direction. And there's this kind of survival for existence. So in cities, people, say, pensioners especially, who have no families, are very, very difficult because their pensions might just cover the rent. And I was walking with Nick Scott through the old part of Riga, and this woman who was fairly decently dressed, she looked quite intelligent, quite well educated, and she came up to me, and in Riga people thought I was Hare Krishna. Seems to be Buddhist monk's karma this lifetime. Can't get out away from it. But so she thought, there's a very good Hare Krishna restaurant in Riga where they have a soup kitchen and they feed a lot of very, very poor, starving people. But anyway, so she thought I was Hare Krishna, and she tried to sell me these postcards. And Nick and I had to get to some place, and we said, you know, we weren't interested, but just she so grabbed my heart, you know, just seeing her predicament, that I just could not forget her. So of course, about 15 minutes later, we were back, and we bought the postcards for twice the price. And she was sitting on a bench, and she was looking at these postcards, and she felt so, you could see she looked so depressed, because she obviously didn't want to be selling postcards or begging. And it was so demeaning for her. It was such a kind of crushing experience. And she was also selling the old Soviet postcards, which no one buys now, because they're, you know, they're kind of all Soviet art, and the Soviets aren't very popular in Latvia right now. So Nick actually loved these postcards because they were so camp. We bought the postcards, and she was just thrilled with joy, because we probably gave her enough money to feed her for a few days at least. And so I could see now she's trying to survive and just kind of living on the edge. So in terms of survival, when I suppose for me, when you know, when someone dies and the emotions are very strong, I've always lived in prosperous societies. This is one thing I realized in being in Eastern Europe. I've always lived in societies which are prospering. Canada, England, Thailand, places like that, New Zealand. And I've never been in a society which is degenerating. And going really, I mean, not just sort of a few things breaking down, the whole kind of system breaking down, the whole empire breaking down. So I've never really had to survive at that level. I've been very, very fortunate. So for me, life has always been a kind of optimistic experience, one of thriving, actually. But I think whether it is survival or thriving, selflessly, is, of course, the essence of the spiritual life. The times that, for me at least, where survival has been, the feeling of survival is when I've not wanted to be a monk, when I've been absolutely fed up with being a monk, when the thought of having to wear this brown robe another day or hear the same Pali chanting another time drives me crazy, the thought of hearing another talk by Ajahn Sumedho. I mean, love is Dhamma, but the mind goes that way sometimes, isn't it? So there is that, those times in our lives, emotionally and socially, where we do feel things aren't kind of going the way we want them to go, and there I think the whole sense of commitment in a social form, in work, in vocation, is one of the essential features of liberation. Because say for my vocation as a monk, if I had just done what I wanted to do, left when I wanted to go, been with the people I wanted to be with, then I'd be always on the move. Because, I mean, how much of the time have I wanted to be a monk? Often I've not wanted to be a monk. So in the practice of living life selflessly, what we try to do, whether it's a dire situation like third world countries in poverty, or whether it's a middle class situation or a monastic situation, is we try to cultivate a vehicle, some form which is bigger than our own desires. So it might be marriage, it might be, in traditional societies, the idea of vocation was important. And then work wasn't just getting the goods and services for a decent existence, that was part of it. But work was one's dharma, you know. Work was one's vehicle. Work is one's vocation, within which one develops the faculties and one abandons selfishness. And without a vehicle, without some kind of outside boundaries which are not just set up by my own whims and my own preferences and my own biases, some kind of boundaries bigger than me, are tremendously helpful. because they reflect for me selfishness. The boundaries of the vehicle have to be taken on voluntarily, or one has to at least acknowledge them somehow. So if boundaries are imposed upon me and I don't consciously take that as a vehicle for liberation, then I'll always resent those boundaries. So say, I was visiting this collective where my mother and my grandparents had a large property there, and then when the Soviets came, they collectivized it and knocked all the little farms down and shoved everyone together and so on. But there was a man. There was a school, English school teacher. She taught English in the primary school, and she didn't have enough to survive, so she was doing subsistence agriculture. She had never done it before. And her husband had been the bus driver for the collective, because in the Soviet system, the collectives would have a bus, and they would do tours to the Eastern Europe or Black Sea, and he was the bus driver for these tours. He had a very interesting job. When the collectives collapsed, there was no such employment anymore. So he lost his purpose in life. And his vehicle, as it were, changed from being the bus driver to no longer being the bus driver to having to milk the cows and slaughter the pig and just get by. Now, he had enough food and he had a roof over his head for the night, and his son had a job. And he's still married. So, you know, on some kind of physical level, it seemed it was okay. But actually, he was getting into alcohol. He was quite depressed. Because he had lost what he thought was, he had lost his life as he saw it. So this kind of new vehicle was imposed upon him. You know, a new constraint was imposed upon him through outside forces. Now, for him, it's just survival. He's just trying to get by, and so he, you know, he's a good man, but the bottle's going to kill him. Because he doesn't really have a spiritual aspiration. And of course, that's the poverty of a system like that, which is totally secular, is that there's no kind of reference point for the inner work. Is simply the external and some kind of external comfort. So he has these boundaries and constraints now. He doesn't have his job. He has to do subsistence agriculture. He doesn't have much money. There's nothing to do. It's a very boring, depressed little place, backwater of the world. Now, in the spiritual life, in the Buddhist life, we always try to make conscious these kinds of constraints and limitations. And rather than blaming them, we try to reflect on our particular attachments within them. And this change of consciousness from one of blame to using the situation as a vehicle for enlightenment is obviously, you know, paramount for freedom. Because as long as I see the constraints of my life as being that which causes me suffering, at one level it's true, yeah, his unemployment makes him depressed, but if he is forever blaming the Soviets or whatever, then there's no chance for freedom. And his mind is always enveloped in selfishness, in the sense of it's not fair, it's not right, etc., etc. So his mind is trapped into selfishness, a sad and kind of justifiable suffering, but still he's not free. So in terms of if one sees one's life situation as a vehicle for inner freedom, then one can see that whatever comes to us, it's possible to practice. It might not be easy. So if they chuck me in prison, it's obviously going to be more difficult to practice than in a monastery, because the environment's going to be very violent and so on. But still, if I have that basic hunger and aspiration for inner freedom, then whatever happens, I'm going to use that for understanding, for non-attachment. Now that's not a recipe for absolutely accepting everything. That's not to say that one cannot act socially. So in terms of working selflessly in the world, there's also the whole area of altruism. the whole area, say like Mother Teresa, the work that she's done. So she's been very active and very powerful in her activity, and she's got an amazing amount done. One woman created all this hospices and helped so many people. So selflessness does not imply passivity. It doesn't imply some kind of abject acceptance of the social situation. No, we can still act. We can be political. We can try to motivate our society to be better in various ways. But the key to it is to do it as a way of self-understanding rather than just as a way to get an end in itself. So if I just, you know, like building the temple, the idea of building the temple was to try to create a really helpful environment for meditation. An environment where you go in there, your jaw drops. You go, your mind just drops into silence. It's a jaw dropper. That's the idea. And I think it works. You know, you can see them, builders go in there, they even become silent. Right? But the whole exercise of building the temple is a spiritual exercise only if one takes it day by day and watches selfishness. So there's the goal, there's the temple. But that is secondary to the spiritual work. Primary is the day-by-day attachment to wanting to get it done, or wanting it perfect, or being cheated by a builder, or you know, all that kind of stuff that we go through. And practicing and observing that and learning to let go. And what do we let go of? We learn to let go of the endless I thoughts, really. We learn to bring the mind to the sense of silently witnessing to the way things are. If you notice how selfishness works as a kind of phenomena of mind, the sense of I arises with some kind of situation. For instance, if I think, let's say I'm going to go to Prague in November. Okay, I have an invitation to go to Prague, so the thought comes in, I'll go to Prague. Oh, it'll be nice. Go see Prague. I hear it's really lovely. Prague's really lovely. I wonder, how long should I stay? Maybe I'll go over to Vienna too while I'm there. And so the mind goes blah, 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 blah. But that's a sense of I, isn't it? Me being in Prague having a good time. I might not have a good time, but my mind doesn't consider that. So I'm going to have a good time. But that sense of me as a person in time arises with a future memory, doesn't it? It's one thing, actually. Or if I have a thought of someone who betrayed me 5 years ago, and that memory is triggered off in my mind, the sense of I will come up in what way? It'll come up in a different way. It'll come up, oh, that was so unfair. How could they do that to me? I was so kind to them. They stabbed me in the back, and I did all that. If I ever see them again, I'm going to cut their throat. You know, I'm going to... So the sense of self arises with that memory, but it's actually one thing. It's one package. It's one package. Worry, fear, anxiety, fantasy, all these things are actually... The sense of I is just this kind of changing thing. It's coming and going according to these different factors. But what's behind it, what's around it, what's through it, is awareness and silence and emptiness. And this is what the spiritual inclination is, to begin to notice that, rather than to be that sense of little me and little mine caught up in all the thoughts and ideas. So selflessness for me doesn't imply... Again, it doesn't imply any kind of false humility or passivity. It simply implies beginning to see how the sense of I arises in thought and connected to emotion and memory and time and all of that, and no longer allowing my mind to go down that track. And what we do find is the mind does go down certain kinds of tracks. It goes down the track of worry or the track of excitement, or the track of resentment, or the track of greed, hatred, and delusion, various ways. Yeah? And so what we try to do, say, in monastic life, is we create a vehicle. Okay, so we have rules, and we have a kind of community here. And then within that, of course, there's times I like it, times I dislike it. There's times I like the people, times I dislike the people. There's times I want to give a talk, most of the times I don't want to give a talk. But that becomes secondary. What I want for myself becomes secondary. What becomes primary is the vehicle and me functioning in the vehicle. Now within that sometimes I can get the secondary, I can get what I want. But lots of times I can't. So if I can get the secondary, I go for it. Which is, it's allowed. You know, it's all right. But much of the time, it's not that way. Lots of the times, that one has duties and one has to do things perhaps that one, or be with people that one feels uncomfortable and all the rest of it. And within that, when desire is not satisfied, when desire is not fulfilled, then a sense of I comes up very strongly. And so the sense of I is pushed by desire. And that selfishness. I want the world to be a certain way for me. I want you to be a certain way for me. I want the monastery to be a certain way for me. Or I don't want to be in the monastery or whatever configuration one takes. A kind of wanting the life to be this way or not wanting life to be that way. Or I just want distraction. I just want to absorb into the world of senses and so on. And so the sense of I arises very strongly. Now if I have the attentiveness, if I have the awareness to actually look at that, to actually see how that sense of I arises, and I stay within the form and vehicle, and I don't feed that, but I do fully experience it. I still feel the restlessness of unfulfilled desire. You can't get around that. That's part of the game. That's part of the, I mean, it doesn't come for free, does it? Freedom. So in that sense of being committed to something bigger than myself, bigger than my own desires, desire is frustrated. Now the frustration of desire is not bad. It just is the way, even if you try to get everything you want, go for it, you're still going to be frustrated. Because the nature of desire that cannot be fully satisfied. And so in the frustration of desire, and in the commitment to a vehicle or a vocation, or marriage or whatever it might be, there's the arising of suffering. As self, as me, as what I want. And the practice of letting go is beginning to witness to that and not get lost in the thoughts about it, which is neither repressive nor is it indulgent. It doesn't repress the feelings of desire and wanting things to be other than they are, and neither does it indulge in them. It knows them. And in that knowing, our hearts need a tremendous amount of love, actually. Not the love of liking, not the love of preference, but the love of total acceptance. It's a different kind of love. It's a spiritual love. It's a transcendent love. It's the ability to accept into consciousness something quite maybe unpleasant and not judge it, but just to know it. And that's pure knowing or pure awareness. And pure awareness must be conjoined with this form of accepting compassion and kindness and metta. We talk about it that way. But not just as a kind of emotion. So that kind of transcendent love is not the same as like liking someone. You know, I can dislike someone and fully know that in transcendent love. Can you get that? Because that's quite important. That I can be with something that comes up into my heart. Let's say I'm sitting in the room and someone comes in and they're doing something which I feel is inappropriate. I start to feel irritated. Now I can know that irritation in a fully accepting way. And if I know that irritation in a fully accepting way, I can act. I can act from wisdom. I can be passive. That doesn't really matter. But I don't feed it. Neither do I feed it with repression, neither do I feed it with indulgence. And that tendency of selfishness actually dies because I don't feed it. Because my attention is more on transcendent love rather than on the particular scenario, on the particular thing that I'm caught up with. And it's that movement to something broader and greater in each moment which for me, the practice of selflessness is about. Total acceptance, these kinds of things. So to do this, if you don't have a vehicle, it's very hard. And the vehicle we prescribe or suggest in Buddhism is very obvious. It's precepts, a moral vehicle. Some forms of sense restraint, commitment to social codes, commitment to people, relationships, in some kind of decent way where we can reflect and contemplate. Now, sometimes people think that selflessness means being very dutiful. So, you know, like I'm in the monastery, I'm a senior monk, I must perform my duty. I must go to the morning meditation and I must be kind to all the novices and the nuns, and I must really be grateful for the food, and then I must give this talk. And then I have to be on time, must be on time, have to set an example, a good example, never nod during meditation, never slurp my soup and spill it on my robe, and then I'll be practicing selflessness, right? But that's a life of misery. Nothing more depressing. Because that's just control. And that's what sometimes we mistake selflessness for, some kind of just controlling the emotions. You know, just kind of, just hold on, Viradhammo, don't let that one come out. But it's the opposite, actually. It's a full embracing of life within a social context. The social context defines action and speech. The attitude of transcendent love is what liberates all the negativity, what liberates all the selfishness. So what happens often from our kind of idealism, attachment to altruism, is we get attached to duty. And that's not the same as using a vehicle for reflection and surrender. Attachment to duty is still ego, isn't it? You know, if I do this monastic thing and I'm just doing it out of a sense of duty, and I'm just creating a more sense of, yes, I'm very, very dutiful and they're not very, very dutiful, and I'm being a good monk and they're not being good monks and nuns and so on, where's the happiness? Forget it. So that's attachment to duty, and that has to be seen. So what happens, maybe people, they think, well, I'm not going to be attached to duty, so there's just this kind of laissez-faire attitude. Everything goes, licentious behavior. But that's not it either. That's throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That's not it. Yeah? The skillfulness of a lifestyle is to use constraint, to use limitations, to use commitments in order to actually witness not wanting to be dutiful. Being absolutely fed up with one's duties and still doing them. That's the trick. Or not doing them and see what's the result. Within reasonable limits. So sometimes I just get, you know, fed up with whatever in the monastery. And there's some things, if I got fed up with them and I followed my mind, I wouldn't be a monk anymore. So there's a few things I wouldn't do. But there's something, you know, just I'm fed up with meditating. I don't go to meditation anymore. They watch that kind of childishness. And sometimes I'd go. And sometimes I'd not go. Huh? But the higher thing was always, no, my duty is to go to meditation. So I said, okay, I'll use that. Okay, I have to go. Morning meditation. These are the early years. I love meditation now. But the early years, I hated it. And I really did. Because my knees hurt and it was concrete floors and mosquitoes biting you and most of the monks were falling asleep anyway, and it was just, you know, sort of very cynical, negative attitude to the whole thing. And so my desire mind was, I'm fed up, and I can practice better in my own hut anyway. And then my duty mind said, you must go for your Dhammo, you're a monk now, you're being fed by the lay people, you must go to meditation. So I'd have this argument. You know, I'd wake up in the morning, have this argument, and then I'd go to the meditation, or I wouldn't go to the meditation. But there was no mindfulness in that. There was no awareness, because all of it was still the I thought. So either the I thought would come up, I must go, I must go, I must go, or the I thought would come up, I don't want to go, I don't want to go, I don't want to go. But where is the freedom there? It's the same thing. She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. It's the same I thought. There's no liberation from that. So if our commitment is just from that, we will hate it. It'll be like a, you know, like a kind of weight on us. So then I'd learn to use the form. I'd say, okay, it's easy. You just go on your watch. So then wake up, and now it's the time to meditate. Right, I don't want to go, fine, go. And then I just watch. And so there's a kind of freedom. And that's what I found, that the commitment and vehicle and form was the freedom to watch, but not the freedom to get what I wanted. And you see the difference. That I didn't have the freedom just to... I had the freedom, I could leave any time. It was a kind of all or nothing kind of freedom there. So, I mean, I can leave any time. Monasticism is that way. We're not bound by any kind of lifetime vows. But basically, I said, well, I'm going to try this for a while. So it became very, very simple. It's time to meditate. It's time to go work. Time to do some building work. It's time to go hear the teacher. And in that, when I began to discover that, I had this tremendous freedom to just do it and watch. But there wasn't the kind of attachment to duty. It was more understanding the game, as it were. You know, when you play basketball, you don't put on skates. Yeah. You don't put on your ice skates when you play basketball. So this was a game. I'm a monk. I have these rules. I have these constraints. And within that, I can watch. I can watch the liking, the disliking, the boredom, and no longer just buy into all of that. Begin to let go of that. And then letting go is a gentle art of no longer believing in the I thought. The I thought is a kind of holding in the mind. It's a tension. The letting go of that is a full opening to the way things are. It's just like opening your hand. It's just switching the light switch on and off. It's that gentle opening to the way things are, not a rejection, not an indulgence, but the way things are, that is the continual practice of selflessness. A kind of little by little practice that we're always trying to do in our training, in our monastic training, in any Buddhist training. So that requires attentiveness. One has to be on the ball. You have to be with it, with life as it's going. The key is that I thought. The key is something, the difference between planning and worrying. Planning is okay. It's the skillful use of thought. I need to do something next week, so I have to fill in my diary and plan transport, and that's fine. Worry is different. Worry is the I thought, oh, is it going to work? Maybe it won't work, and maybe they won't like me, they'll like me, and I shouldn't have taken this anyway, I shouldn't have done no. That's worry. So how do you let go of worry? Well, you say, no, stop worrying. That's still the I thought, isn't it? It's a kind of person in there just telling you what to do. Stop worrying now. Yes, okay, I'll stop worrying. I will stop worrying. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because that's repression. Okay, then I'll really worry. That doesn't work either. So what's the middle way? The middle way is seeing the arising of that feeling of worry, seeing it go into the I thought, and letting go of the thought, but feeling the feeling. Which is more like an opening and an awakening to what you're feeling. Now that might just come up constantly, again and again and again. And then we can use like skillful means within that. I have one with worry I just play with. I say to the silence of the mind, you do it. Which sounds weird, doesn't it? So as my mind starts to worry about, what am I going to say today? And things like that. That's what comes up for me a lot. Then I just feel that worry, I let go of the thought, and I just say, you do it. Now, there's no one's going to do it. it'll just do it. But I say that to the silence of my mind. And that's something I've developed from just looking at worry and seeing the whole sense of me in time and the future and how much suffering that really is. And yet still being responsible within my duties, still honoring the convention of time, but no longer feeding that sense of me in the future, what's going to happen, anticipation, and so on. Or things like, say just wanting something, just the greed, and seeing the mind play with that, and just letting go of the thought, and then putting in a thought like, yeah, but you might drop dead tomorrow. Or, some kind of suggestion to bring the mind to the sense of suchness. This is the way it is now. And this is where we really thrive. This is where we really thrive, is when we can bring our minds to the present moment, to the emptiness of the mind, to the clarity of the mind, like Lompo calls it, intuitive intelligence. Because from that, we get the most fresh responses, the most creative responses, which is a kind of moment-by-moment thing. So for, on the kind of altruistic level, on the level of work, there's tremendous fulfillment and joy in being able to live in a society where we can have some sense of expression. So we're very privileged that way often, that we can read and we can investigate and we can travel and we can change jobs and we can have jobs. I think these are often very great luxuries in the world. But even that, if it doesn't have a spiritual dimension into it, if it doesn't have some sense of finding refuge within oneself, then it will always bring despair. Because it can never satisfy. It can fulfill for a while, but it can never fully satisfy. So if for some reason our lives are taken to the sense of despair, through death, through loss of job, through divorce, through these kinds of things, well, we can only survive, really. We can't change it anymore. It's just happened and we're with it and we have to survive. Then I think, like, the feelings of despair and those feelings of loneliness that we have are actually tremendously important for the spiritual path. Not that I recommend you kind of go out there and get despairing, or not that I hope you have that, but we do have that. We do have those feelings. And my inquiry into those feelings is that if I can just leave them alone and be with them, if I cannot try to analyze them, if I cannot see that there's anything wrong with despair and loneliness, if I can just simply love them, maybe that's too strong, but be with them and allow them to be in consciousness, and if I have the trust, and this does take a lot of trust, to fully be with those feelings, then what I find, the need to become something, the need to be a certain type of person, happy and fulfilled, that need dies. And what's left is the silent mind, which is not restless with need, which is not filled with the need to become. But to go through that, to bear with things like despair or loneliness, because we define them in our society as being wrong. Something wrong with you. Oh, cheer up. This is what I find sometimes when, like the last few weeks, I've been really inquiring into willpower and time. I do these strange kind of inquiries. And just the very nature of will. And I found that very often it took my mind to a sense of despair. Because what I do is I didn't investigate will and then say, make no effort. This is what I've been sort of practicing the last few weeks. And what I found, it brought my heart to a very kind of strong sense of despair. And yet, I have nothing to focus it on. I have nothing to blame. My life is very lovely, and I have an interesting life. And so there's just this very raw feeling of despair. And I found if I tried to analyze that, or I said there's something wrong with it, I would mess it up. So I just would sit with it and allow it to be. And it's pretty hard, being a senior monk here and feeling despair, everyone looks at you. And then, first of all, they think they've done something wrong. And they say, oh, Bhante, would you like to go to Wales? Do you need a holiday? Or someone, get a little chocolate bar. Actually, it's nice that way. But, and I could see, like, socially, being in that mind state is socially unacceptable. There's something wrong. But actually, there's nothing wrong. Right? And to take that feeling of despair or loneliness or whatever it might be, and to actually trust that there is nothing wrong, and it is just the way it is, for me, has been very rewarding. Because sitting through that and being like, sometimes I'm in meetings and I look like a real black cloud. You know, Ajahn Sumedho is giving a talk and I'm just sitting there like a grump. And everyone's looking at me. But somehow I don't care anymore. And I think quite often you need that kind of courage in the spiritual life. Because if you're always just pumping out your personality to make others happy, it's awful, isn't it? And that's what we often do. We create personality for other people's comfort, or what we perceive to be other people's comfort, or what we feel comfortable with. But what is it? Freedom isn't kind of a personality plus operation. It's the death of ego. It's the die before you die. Huh? And so that's what I found, investigating states like despair, and where you can only kind of survive with them. If I can just fully honor that feeling as a function in nature, as nothing wrong, then through that there is a love and a peace which is not based on desire, which isn't based on getting anything. It's the natural consequence of the heart which is liberated from that. But as long as those mind states, I always need to analyze them because I think there's something wrong, or I always need to get rid of them or distract them, then the mind will always have a fundamental restlessness. It won't have a profound peace, and it won't have a profound love. Why? Because it can't accept that. That's a transcendent love. As long as my heart cannot accept something like despair, then there won't be the transcendent love. It can't be. Transcendent love implies non-preference, non-judgment. Openness. Yeah? Those are the images that religion always gives. Selflessness and self-surrender. So the refuge then is like in Buddhism, the way to deal with that, you have to have something more than the rational mind. If you just have thought in the rational mind, you're always trying to figure it out. Whereas the spiritual life implies endurance. You have to learn to endure these things, but not through love kind of feeling. And faith. Faith in what? Well, faith in knowing. Faith in awareness. Faith in that kind of clarity of witnessing to the way things are. Not faith in dogma. Faith in dogma is just more thought. That's just more thinking. Faith, endurance, wisdom, love, these kinds of things are really the liberating qualities of the heart. And then our vocation, you know, then our vocation is one of abandoning self-centeredness. Not just through some kind of altruism and duty, but something more profound, something more spiritual. All right, I think I'll leave it there for now. Maybe break for a cup of tea and then come together and have some questions if anyone has. Start with the question that's already come and then open to the floor. The difference between transcendent love and personal love. I guess that one of the difficulties in the English language is that the word loved is used so broadly. I love fish and chips and so on. So it's a hard word. And I'm actually looking for another word for transcendent love, but bear with me while I'm looking for it. but what I'm trying to indicate for my own practice is that that in consciousness we have a whole set of experiences, and those experiences are polar, dualistic. So love and hate, like, dislike, dark and light, hot and cold. So this is kind of polarity. And love at the level of liking, is different than transcendent love. Transcendent love is the all-encompassing, which includes the polarities, which includes loving and hating. So it's something which isn't personal, but it knows the movement of these polarities, which knows hot and cold, which knows liking and disliking. In the text, they would talk about a mother's love, you know, which is kind of beyond, because lots of times a mother will be fed up with her child, I think, huh? I've never had one. But there'll be something deeper than just the liking or the disliking. Yeah? And that's what we're trying to point to in the religious life. There's some kind of a quality in consciousness which is totally accepting and non-judgmental. And in terms of yet there's also a discriminating mind, which we need. I need to have discernment to know how to act and what's appropriate to do. I need intelligence to know, how to guide my life. So not to deny intelligence and discernment, but to see that which knows the feeling of love and hate, the feeling, the preferences that I have, is always bigger, greater, grander, more encompassing. And that has to me, it seems, it has to have a quality of love in it, because it is totally accepting. It's not judgmental. In terms of people, if in the monastery I find someone is doing something, again, which I think is inappropriate, my duty is to offer some reflection, to say that's inappropriate. That's not the way we train here. Now, I can dislike the person, and I can know that dislike and be patient with it, and it will cease. Or I can feel the dislike and then admonish the person out of dislike and anger. That's different. Or I can feel the dislike and feel guilty about it and think, oh, I'm the senior monk, I should love everyone all the time. You know, which is a pretty heavy trip to lay on me. So you see, we tend to swing between the kind of indulgence or repression, and we get confused, and we have, you know, when you have emotion like hatred, how can you love hatred? But that's exactly what you do. We don't condone it by following it with action and speech, but neither do we condemn it. We see it as a function in nature, which arises because of causes. And its perpetuation only comes when we believe in it, either as something wrong to repression or something we indulge in. And the difficulty of the spiritual life is to have the trust and faith that by witnessing to something like hatred and not following it with action and speech, but knowing it in the heart, that it will actually cease, that its energy will die. And that takes faith, because I think what happens, at least what used to happen for me, is I always thought I had to do something about it. So I do some kind of a practice. May all beings be well, may all beings be well, may all beings be well. And God, I hate this practice anyway. that kind of thing. And it never ceased. Because I wasn't actually loving the anger. I was averse to the anger. The words were all nice. But what my mind was doing was trying to get rid of the anger. So the anger comes up and I think, get out of here. How do I get rid of you? I do metta practice. That's right, I do metta. I do loving kindness practice. Okay, I'll get rid of you if I have loving kindness now. I love you, I love you, I love you, which... So to really go to a deep sense of love, one has to love, has to have some sense of embracing the hatred. And the guidelines of action and speech protect us from following that. Huh? If we are very idealistic, we get confused. Because our ideals is that love is liking everyone and being nice to everyone all the time. And then when the emotions throw up something different to that idea, we feel terribly confused and guilty. And then we hold it down for a while, and then we blow up and we yell at someone, and then we feel guilty and we go through that kind of a cycle. So transcendent love, maybe, I don't know, any other suggestions for that? The language, yes? Yeah. That's even better, maybe. Unconditional love, yeah. Because it's making no, there's no deal. You know, it's like unconditional acceptance of this the way it is. So what I notice in my own mind is always the need to analyze, to judge, to do something about it, rather than the relaxation. And to relax into something like hatred or despair is hard, isn't it? How do you relax into despair? You get drunk. But it's not. It's very subtle that way. And our desire patterns are, of course, always more like reactive things. Reactive things. Okay. Any other questions? Yes? Yes, yeah. Trust in Allah and tie your camel. And tie your camel. I don't know, to be honest. But I think it's probably a bit of both, isn't it? Because we do have the possibility of being attentive. And we do have the possibility of making sure, you know, there's air in the tires and so on. And yet circumstances arise which we don't know about, which are, you know, dependent on other factors. So I think it's a kind of mixture. It's neither a position. Because otherwise you get into the kind of, what do they call it, determinism. One way and the other way is that, you know, there's free choice. And so philosophers tend to argue that there's free choice. No, it's determined. And they kind of go between the two extremes. But I reckon there's, you know, somewhere in the middle way. And ultimately, it is mysterious. Why? And one of the interesting things in the Buddhist text is that the Buddha apparently says that if a human being tries to figure out all the reasons which make up this moment, they'd go bananas. It's impossible to figure out. It's just too complex. Huh? And I think in the spiritual life, that's important because we have to always realize the limit of intellect. The intellect is a tool which can be used, but it cannot be the ultimate goal. So the intellect can't give you all the answers. But it gives you a few answers, actually. But the intellect can be the tool which takes you to the edge of silent awareness, from which the enlightenment can take place, or is the enlightenment. Yeah? So quite often, you know, what we do in Buddhism is allow ourselves not to know. And I found that very liberating, because I was always trying to figure out what enlightenment was, and which is a real headache. But what I didn't see is this desire to know in terms... I didn't see the desire. And I couldn't have, say, unconditional love for not knowing. See? Because I had the desire to know. And so then I'd think and I'd get an answer and... There was an interesting book by a guy who wrote Grace and Grit. Ken Wilber, yeah. He's a great synthesizer of all philosophies. The Atman Project or one of these books that he wrote. And for once in my life, I knew it all. You know, I knew how Krishnamurti fit in and Gestalt therapy and Buddhism and shamanism. I knew it all. I had it all. 2 days later, I was confused. And that was very interesting for me because I could see the confidence of having an intellectual structure which I thought was complete. Oh, yeah, well, that's beautiful. It's like a lovely gem, you know? And then it all started to crumble. And I could see how the confidence in intellect then was just conditioned. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't the unconditioned. It was conditioned. And then when the factors were there for doubt to start to come up, it started to crumble. And then I saw, oh yeah, but I can know that. I can know the feeling of not knowing. Huh? And that was a kind of great bigger principle than knowing in terms of intellect. Like Ajahn Sumedho says, when you turn all the lights out and it's completely dark, that which knows it's dark is light. Yeah? So I think with an intellect that's quite important. To know its limits, to know what it can do, to know what it can't do. Buddhists use that as a way of acceptance. It's a very, very skillful way of learning to accept things. The danger is it gets fatalistic. You know, it's my karma, I'll just have to get drunk tonight. So, but it can, you know, I've seen, there was one nice example, there was a, and I've talked about this before, there was a man in Bangkok who had been really cheated by someone he really, really loved and respected, and the guy ran off with 2 million baht and disappeared in America. And he was shattered. He was shattered. And I saw him about a year later and I said, well, are you still angry at him? He said, well, I was for about a year. And then I thought, yeah, well, maybe I owe him 2 million baht from a past lifetime. I could never think like that. You know, my mind doesn't work that way. So, and yet, yes, Ruki, yeah. Yeah, I think that's Abhidhamma says that, I think, yeah. Which is, I think, genetic theory, I think, talks about that. But I've never been able to hold those ideas in my mind somehow, because I tend to just hold in my mind what I can know. And beliefs just sort of, they kind of come and go. Any other questions? Anyone? Yes? If it's selfless ambition. Well, let's say want to build a temple, like I was saying, okay? And I feel that that would be a good thing for society. Then I can, you know, activate the energies that I have and the society has to build that. Now within that, I will have selfish impulses. You know, I want my color tiles and I won't want the nuns' color tiles, or you know, I want blue walls and they want white walls, or I want to get it done fast and then it's not. So there'll be all the kind of selfish impulses might come through there. But I can watch that for the sense of creating something for the good of my society. So in terms of like family, you can work to have a strong position in a job so that your family can be well fed, so that you have power to influence society. You can do all of that. It's hard. Because the trouble is, the ambition to succeed becomes paramount to the selflessness, right? But it's not impossible. And so you can have the intention to make £1 million because you want to build a hospice and go for it. But if on the way you then compromise morality and all the rest of it, and at the end, you probably won't build a hospice. You know, you go for another million. I'm sorry? Probably. Once you get addicted to that, that's the problem. But if you keep, you know, I mean, like to have a career and to get a job and to do it for the sake of being a strong person in society and making a contribution, whether it's in Hewlett Packard or wherever you work, you know, IBM or GLC, whatever, you know. It doesn't really matter if you keep that spiritual center going. And then, of course, you have the difficulties that people around you maybe aren't that very spiritual. And you get all the ugliness of competition and backstabbing, and that's very hard. That's very hard. You have purity of, you know, you have pure aspiration, and someone maybe uses that. So you have to be careful to see that Buddhism doesn't mean you have to be a doormat. You know, compassion doesn't mean that people can wipe their feet on your nose. And so then you learn how to try to be strong in social situations, but not from ego and anger, but from just strength of wisdom. And my experience of that was Ajahn Chah, our teacher in Thailand, the monk here. And he was very powerful. No one messed about with him. He just didn't. If you give him any BS, I mean, he just caught you. And yet, there was tremendous compassion there. It's like that was very inspiring, because I saw a man who had tremendous power and charisma, but used it for the sake of you know, creating very good things in society. So he influenced generals, and wealthy people and poor people and Westerners and so on. So power, charisma, all these things needn't be egotistical. But they easily become that. You know, it's you know, charisma is such a, say, attractive thing, it's hard not to get addicted to it and then use it for manipulative things or whatever. But like him, he could, I was saying this the other day, that he'd be sitting in we also often have satsang with him. We just go and in the evening after evening meditation, just sit with him. And he would talk dumb or just be silent. And I remember sometimes we'd go there and you'd sit with him, and he'd be very empty. And he looked dead. You know, he looked like just sort of his face would be drooping, because there was no kind of necessity to be a person, as it were. But if my mind was very silent, actually, I felt his silence. If my mind was busy and I wanted something from him, of course, I got intimidated. So sometimes I go there and I just sit in the silence of that, of his space, in that space. And then someone would come from town, a Thai villager, and they'd be, you know, having problems, and, you know, the crop had failed, or the kids are into dope, or, you know, something like that. And then Ajahn Chah would come alive. You know, all charm and charisma, and, you know, and he'd give them a Pepsi or something, and talk, and they go away feeling cheered. They still had their problems to deal with, but they'd feel somewhat uplifted. They'd leave, and then he'd go dead again. But it wasn't the deadness of depression. It was actually an aliveness in him. So I could see how, you know, like personality can manifest from a different place rather than just from like an ego need and so on. For me, it's the good of the community, and occasionally a good cup of tea. I mean, you know, there's some things I do for myself which I think are healthy, some things I do for myself which not are healthy. Eat lots of chocolate. You know, so I realize that this being needs things. So sometimes there's that motivation. So sometimes I just got to get out of here. You know, the place getting to me, and I got to go for a walk. And then I go for a walk. And I talk to the trees. It's very nice. Huh? And sometimes I've got to go for a walk, but I can't go for a walk. And then I stay. And we all have that. So there's motivation to take care of this being, which comes not from selfishness, but from compassion and sensitivity and caring, you know, exercise and all of that. So there's that kind of motivation. And then there's the motivation in my family. So then I try to, because my mother's getting elderly, I try to look out for her as much as I can. You know, I visit her more and more, and like this year I'm going to go there in February, because she gets really kind of depressed at the end of February. Canadian winters are abominable. So by end of February, people are very depressed. So there's that kind of motivation, and there's a motivation in the larger community. So, you know, how can I try to create a good environment from, because I have some power here, how can I help the monks and nuns, and you know. But I can't always be in the mode of helping the other monks and nuns. Sometimes I just have to go back here, and I just say, let them drop dead. I'm taking care of Viradhammo. And that's very important. Otherwise I get too idealistic about what I can do. So there can be motivation from a sense of responsibility of one's position in society, and then, you know, being motivated from that. And I do think the older one gets, the more one should lead. So I really feel that being 50 years old, that's my responsibility to lead. You know, that I should, you know, if after this many years as being a human being, I can't offer some guidance. I shouldn't be, you know, I should get my act together. So I do think leadership is a kind of part of, you know, being a decent member of society, of, you know, working in some way. I think that's an important part of it. So there's that, you know, all kinds of motivations that way. And within that, there's also the selfish motivations, you know, being fed up and wanting to, you know, there's all that goes on too. I'm not kind of an innocent thing. But that, if I don't believe, I believe that less and less and less, because it's just too painful. I sometimes get lost in it, you know, and so on, but it's just too painful now. So my own life has been that. It's always been that kind of mixture of motivations. And by just watching the motivations which are self-serving, I've never found very, very happy or productive. So if you keep that in mind, you know, and you watch yourself, just watch what's the result of your ambitions and efforts. And if those results are unhappy or unfruitful, then contemplate why. And then you judge what, you know, your direction, you find your own direction. But you can't know it all at once. You have to kind of fumble along and bumble along and make your mistakes and so on. But I was in New Zealand 9 years, and I was a lovely project to build a monastery, and that is such a good memory in my mind now. It's such a good feeling of having been a part of that and having done that. So then, the more one operates in that kind of way, be it family or monastery, then the result in the heart is a natural kind of peacefulness, because the heart has a kind of happiness. But if I can imagine if I had just not honored what is true in my own heart, then I'd have a lot of regrets and remorse now. I might have gotten what the ego mind wanted, but the heart wouldn't be happy.